studying tonight from the book of Hebrews. And we're in the 13th chapter, and we want to talk about some things from the 13th chapter in verse 4. But before we do that, one of the purposes of this study is to try to remember the things that are in each chapter, to have some kind of an idea when a topic comes up, where to turn to in the book of Hebrews to discuss that topic. And so as we identify some things from these chapters, I want you to try to remember them. In the first chapter, what becomes the theme of that chapter? The first chapter, and keep in mind, there's a word that becomes the theme really of the whole book. What word is that? Better, that's right. We see the book of Hebrews being a book of contrast. We see better being discussed throughout the book. In the first chapter, what do we note as the theme of that chapter? Hebrews chapter 1. All right, Christ is better or superior than what? The prophets. And then in the latter part of that chapter, he's superior to the angels. And then on into the second chapter, we see that he's better than the angels. And then in the third chapter, he's better than Moses. That's right. And of course, as we discuss the relationship of Christ to Moses, we see the relationship of Christ to the law and the will of Christ to the law. And then in the fourth chapter, the theme involves, let us fear. Let us fear. We find that expression occurring a number of times, or let us occurring a number of times in the fourth chapter, beginning at verse 1, let us fear. And then in the 11th chapter, let us give diligence, our verse. And then in the 14th verse, let us hold fast our confession. And then in the 16th verse, let us draw near. So when you think of the fourth chapter, you think of the let us statements of the book of Hebrews. In the fourth chapter in verse 14 beginning, every time we've done this, I pause to note these verses in particular because I think that they are so important to us as it establishes the priesthood of Christ. In Hebrews chapter 4 beginning in verse 14, it says, having then a great high priest, who hath passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we have not a high priest that cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but one that hath been in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore draw near with boldness unto the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and may find grace to help us in time of need. This passage becomes so significant. Because as Jesus is our high priest, we have the privilege then of drawing near unto the Father. Under that Old Testament system, we find that those under that system stood at a distance, as it were, from the Father, being separated from the Father by a separate priesthood, that is, identified as the Levitical priesthood under the law of Moses. But as priest in the house of God, we can draw near through Jesus, the high priest. And of course, that I believe is what the writer is establishing in verses 14 through verse 16. But drawing near is something that we see we have the privilege to do under this new system. We can draw near or approach the throne of God. In the fifth chapter, in the first 10 verses, or rather the 11th verse through the sixth chapter, we see an interruption to the discussion of the priesthood of Christ. What is that interruption? Immaturity. That's right. The writer rebukes them because they are not as mature as they ought to be. In fact, they have need of milk instead of solid food. Picking up again in the seventh chapter, the writer again discusses the priesthood. And we see the contrast of the old priesthood and the new priesthood. In the 11th verse of the 7th chapter, the writer says, now if there was perfection through the Levitical priesthood, for under it hath the people received the law, what further need was there that another priest should arise after the order of Melchizedek and not be reckoned after the order of Aaron? The writer is establishing a separate priesthood, a new priesthood in relation to the Levitical priesthood. The 8th chapter, what becomes the theme of that chapter? Now remember, the theme of the book is better. What is being contrasted in the 8th chapter? Better covenant. That's right. We have a better covenant. And then in the 9th chapter, what's better? The tabernacle. That's right. We have a new and more perfect tabernacle as opposed to that Old Testament tabernacle. And then in the 10th chapter, we have a better sacrifice. That's right. One sacrifice for all time. And then in the 11th chapter, the great halls of faith. We read of the faith of numerous individuals that are to demonstrate the kind of faith that we ought to have. And then in the 12th chapter, the writer tells us to take our eye off of these witnesses and focus on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, then ultimately upon heavenly Zion. That's right. And so we see these themes in these various chapters, and I want you to remember that. Now, in the 13th chapter, we see what I like to call a sundry of things dumped into one chapter. First of all, he talks about the love of the brethren. He uses the word continue, which indicates that they do love each other, and they've demonstrated that in the past. But the writer is encouraging them to let that continue. He says, "Forget not to show love unto strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unaware." These have done this, I believe, in times past. In verse 3, he says, "Remember them that are in bonds, as bound with them that are ill-treated, as being yourselves also in the body." They've done that. In the 10th chapter, verses 32 and the next several verses, we find how that they have suffered with their brethren, been made partakers with them in the things that they've suffered, and the writer is encouraging them to continue in these things. Now, we've hung up a little bit on verse 4, that deliberately. I've wanted to talk about verse 4 at some length because of the importance of understanding what fornicators and adulterers are. Because in this context, the writer says, God will judge. Now that's important. We don't want to fall under the condemnation of God because we don't understand what fornication and adultery are. We must be able to identify these things and keep ourselves out of those things lest we fall under the condemnation of God. Now, in numerous studies, we've laid the groundwork all the way back to Genesis 2, verses 18 through verse 25. And we've noted in that text that God said that it's not good for man to be alone. That is then the beginning of the marriage relationship, verse 18. We saw in verse 24 that God made them male and female and said, "For this cause shall a man leave father and mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and the two shall be one flesh." Had somebody talking with me this week, they'd watched a television program where a man was trying to defend having two wives or multiple wives, saying that in Old Testament history, there were occasions where this was the fact. Now, we're going to talk about that just a little bit in our study tonight, but as you'll notice in the text of Genesis chapter 2, and in verse 24, the two shall be one flesh. Doesn't talk about three or four or five. Says he created the male and female and said, "For this cause shall a man leave father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall be one flesh." Now what do we learn from God's law in the beginning? God's rule is one man for one woman for life. Now that's simple. That's not hard to understand. That's God's rule governing the marriage relationship. Now we find that when Jesus commented on that in Matthew chapter 19, as the Pharisees had asked the question in verse 3, "Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause?" Jesus referred them to what God said in the beginning. You remember that? And said, "Let not man put asunder what God has joined together." They then raised the question, "Well, what about what Moses said in Deuteronomy 24? Jesus said that Moses, for the hardness of your hearts, suffered you to put away your wives, but from the beginning it hath not been so." Now it's important in our minds that we understand clearly that Jesus is not referring to the law of Moses. Jesus is referring to God's law from the beginning. From the beginning it hath not been so. And so that's the law that we want to understand. We find that from the beginning there have been deviations from God's law. We've studied in Genesis chapter 4 how that Lamech took two wives. That was a departure from God's way. The man on the TV show that was trying to defend having multiple wives cannot do anything but refer to God's law from the beginning. That's what Jesus did. One man, one woman for life. What Lamech did was a departure from God's way. We read in Genesis chapter 12 concerning Abraham, how that Abraham offered his wife as his sister, you remember, so that she could potentially become another man's wife. That was a departure from God's way. And we also might note in Genesis chapter 16, when God had promised Abraham a son, who was it that Abraham went in unto to produce a son? Hagar, that's right, Sarah's handmaid. That was a departure from God's plan from the beginning. We also note in Genesis chapter 25 that Abraham had concubines. That was a departure from God's plan from the beginning. Now you might ask me questions about that I wouldn't even attempt to answer. I don't know the answers to. Why didn't God strike Abraham dead? Why is it that Abraham is referred to three times in the Scriptures as the friend of God when he did these things? Now I can't answer that. But what I can answer is that what Abraham did was a departure from God's plan, from God's pattern, from the beginning. We know that's so. We know that's so. Now, if you'll turn to or mention or reference Genesis chapter 26, we notice that Isaac did the same thing in verses 1 through verse 11. He offered his wife, claiming that she was his sister, so that she potentially could become the wife of another man. That was a departure from God's plan. And again, in Genesis chapter 30, we see that Isaac went in unto a handmaid. This too was a departure from God's plan. What we want to see is when Jesus said, from the beginning, it hath not been so. It doesn't make any difference who participated in it. Jesus said, this is not God's plan. It's not His plan for marriage from the beginning. Now we see in Deuteronomy 24, and I know we've talked about this numerous times, so we're not going to spend any time on it. But what we do see in Deuteronomy 24 is Moses regulating a practice that seems to be rampant among the Jews, even during New Testament times. You see, prompting the Jews' question, a practice that has gone rampant. In verse 3 of Matthew 19, can a man put away his wife for just any cause? Well, what do you suppose had prompted that question? The Jews were putting away their wives for just any cause. Now they want to know, can a man do that lawfully? There was a school of thought that said, oh yeah, you can do that lawfully. Jesus referred to God's plan from the beginning and said, no, you can't do that. We find that those in Romans, the first chapter, as we've been studying on Sunday morning, they practiced homosexuality, a whole host of moral sins. And the text tells us that God gave them up unto a reprobate mind to practice those things that are not fitting. Now, whatever the Jews were practicing when they were divorcing for just any cause, or whatever the Gentiles were practicing, engaging in all forms of fornication, it was a departure from God's pattern from the beginning. If you can't remember this chart, you just ask me and I'll print one out for you. I think it's that important that we understand departures from God's pattern do not justify man to live in these methods as we see on this chart. Okay? Man can't do that. Not with God's approval. Now in the last study, I felt sorry for how I treated Terry. I got sick during the day, and sicker as time passed, and then about 5 o'clock, checked my temperature, and I had 101 fever, and I thought, you didn't need that. So I called Terry at 5 o'clock, and he said, well, send me your charts. I said, they're at the building. So I came down to the building, got my computer, and sent Terry the charts, and he was teaching from my charts cold turkey. Well, almost cold turkey. But this was a chart that I wanted to be emphasized. I'm sure that you studied this last Wednesday evening. But divorced people remain under the constraint of divine law. Now that's a concept that's foreign to a lot of people. A lot of people think, well, I'm divorced. And because I'm divorced, I can do what I want to. I can form all kinds of new relationships because after all, you see, I'm single. Well, we need to remember that divorced people remain under the constraint of divine law. You remember in the discussion of Deuteronomy 24, the first several verses of that chapter, for some unseemly thing, you remember? Moses said that a man may put a writing of divorcement into his wife's hand and send her away. Joey?
Another common misconception is that there are people that have gotten a divorce, unscripturally so perhaps, and then they become a Christian.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that.
They're under the understanding that, yeah, I shouldn't have gotten that divorce,
yeah,
but I've been forgiven for
that. Hold that thought. I've got several charts I'm going to deal with. That's right.
Condition is unacceptable, and the parallel that we've drawn before is
that's right.
A person who steals can't be forgiven.
I got a chart on that. That's right. We're going to talk about that in great detail, okay? I've got a series of charts dealing with that very thought. So I'm going to hold that thought till we get to it and go back to Deuteronomy 24. Okay? All right? You remember, oh, John, go ahead. I'm going back to Deuteronomy 24. I have that happen frequently. You want me to go on while you're thinking about it?
I'll start with the second. In Matthew 19:9 it says, "It said to you, whoever divorces his wife except for immorality and marries another woman commits adultery." So I guess my question is, when does God recognize divorce? Because in this case, it seems to me that if adultery is fornication with a married person, then here basically it implies that God does not recognize this divorce at all, except that it's immorality.
Well, I want to talk about that. That's going to take me in an entirely different direction than where I want to go tonight. But I'm going to answer your question. When does God recognize a divorce? I want to suggest to you that God recognizes a divorce when a divorce occurs. Now that sounds strange to the ears of a lot of people, but I want to suggest to you that in Matthew chapter 19, verse 9, Jesus says that a man may put away his wife for reasons other than fornication. Now let me qualify that. He can't do that lawfully, but it can be done. Now when Jesus said in verse 6, what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. You can't put it asunder with God's approval, but bless your sweet heart, you can put it asunder. Man can separate it though. Man can separate what God has bound together. Jesus says that, and that's the regulation. That's why He's answering this question. He's answering a question relative to divorce. Can a man divorce his wife for just any cause? Jesus, in that context, says, don't put asunder what God has joined together. He's talking about divorce.
Is He saying don't, or is He saying
can't? He's saying you can, but He's saying don't. Let not man do it. That's right.
So is that because she was never married again, or she was never divorced from the first? Because if the woman had now was not her husband.
How do we know she wasn't just living with that man without any benefit of marriage at all?
But he also said, but you've had five.
Yes.
Husbands.
Yes. But he doesn't say you've had five legitimate husbands, lawful husbands. No. Man can put asunder. He can destroy the relationship that God has made binding. He can put asunder what God has joined together. That's the very context. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any cause? That's the question that Jesus is answering. Why would He say it if it can't be done?
Well,
Why would he say, let not man put asunder what God has joined if he can't do it anyway? Well, we could talk about that passage too. Those people were teaching another gospel, which is not another. That is, it's not the same one that Paul preached. It's not the same one that Christ authorized. Now, the two words in that passage are different. And I really don't want to take the class in that direction to discuss Galatians chapter 1, verses 6 through verse 9. But what we learn is Jesus is answering a question relative to divorce. And that takes us back to Deuteronomy 24. The Pharisees want to know, what about what Moses said? Now, did what Moses say make a difference in what Jesus had said when he answered their question, let not man put asunder? I'm trying to get back to this, you can tell. Well, we get bound up in our language, and we wind up using language that is not the language of the text. And that's what creates problems for us. We use language, we're bound in God's eyes, loosed in man's eyes, loosed in God's eyes, and we get all bound up with that kind of language. What we need to understand, I think, is to clarify our language. Jesus is talking about divorce. He said, let not man put asunder what God has joined together. Jesus is answering their question. He's answering their question from the standpoint of what man can do and what man cannot lawfully do. Now, can man put asunder what God has joined together? Not lawfully. But now their question is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any cause? Jesus said, let not man put asunder what God has joined. Doesn't mean that it's impossible to do. But he can't do it lawfully. That's the context in which Jesus is answering the question. They then want to argue with him. What about Deuteronomy 24? Deuteronomy 24 introduces a whole other set of rules. Deuteronomy 24 discusses a man who has put away his wife for some unseemly thing. And I think it's noteworthy just here. And you can tell I'm trying to get back to Deuteronomy 24. But when Jesus is answering their question regarding that text, Moses did not permit a putting away for just any cause, and that's the context of their question. Moses said, for this cause, something short of adultery, but not just anything. And we know that it was something short of adultery because if a man committed adultery with a woman, the woman was to be stoned to death, and so was the man. There would be no remarriage, as we see in Deuteronomy 24. Very quickly, Peggy, I'm going to get back to this. Yes.
To denote an unscriptural divorce, and he also uses marriage.
Yes.
As a term for an adulterous.
Yeah.
Marriage. And I think that's the context we have to go by. You know, he uses those words.
Yes, he does, and we can certainly see that it's possible to be married to this one and be that one's wife. We're going to talk about that from Matthew 14 and Mark chapter 6. I've got a chart on that. But right now, let's go back to Deuteronomy 24, okay? What we want to learn from Deuteronomy 24 is that this woman who is divorced from her husband, he may divorce that woman, but he may never have her back after the second marriage. Do we see that? She may become another man's wife under the context of Deuteronomy 24. But even though she is divorced by the first man, she is not without restraint of divine law. She may become a second man's wife, but she can never, ever be that first man's wife again. Never. Divine law restrains her. And we also note the other side of that in verses 1 through 4, that she may marry, but she can never, or get it turned around backwards, the divorced wife, or he may divorce his wife, but he can't have her back after the second marriage. And the divorcee may marry another, but then she can't ever return to her first mate. Now, the context of that's important. Yes, Ken?
Just a quick one here. Back in Deuteronomy 24, he could put her away and divorce her, but if she stayed unmarried, she could have went back to him because it's the bed that is defiled.
That's correct.
Well,
if she becomes another man's wife, he can't ever have her back.
Right.
Yeah.
If she don't,
Yeah.
He could put her away and come back.
Yeah, as far as I know, that's true. Yeah, as far as I know, that's true. Now, you discussed in the last study, last Wednesday night, Leviticus chapter 21, from the text of the priesthood, did you not? You talked about the priesthood and how that this divorced woman from Deuteronomy 24, she may become another man's wife, but she can't become a priest's wife. Why not? All right, the priest could not marry someone who had ever been married before. He had to marry a virgin. Now that was to sanctify the priesthood. Here is a woman that may be free from this man and be able to be joined to this man, but this man cannot be a priest. Now that's the restraint of divine law in Leviticus chapter 21. Now when we come to the text of Matthew 5 and Matthew 19:9, what we see in that is Jesus charges one who is the put away fornicator. If that person remarries, what does Jesus charge them with? Adultery. That's right. Now keep in mind, if she is put away not for the cause of fornication, in other words, they have a spat, she burns the beans, a divorce occurs, she remarries, what does Jesus charge her with? Adultery. Now isn't that simple? Now what becomes the exception? Somebody said it. Except for fornication. That then gives the one who's innocent the right to put away the one who is guilty. The one who is innocent then might remarry without sin. Now we need to see that. That's the law of God from the beginning, if you please. One man, one woman, for life, with one exception. Now Matthew 5 and Matthew 19 does not authorize the put away person, whether they be put away as a guilty fornicator or whether they be put away because they burned the beans. These texts do not authorize the put away person to marry another. Now you talked about 1 Corinthians 7 last time, did you not? Okay, I thought you did. I talked with Terry and that was the plan. He was to talk with you about 1 Corinthians 7. I want you to look at verses 10 and 11. 1 Corinthians 7, verses 10 and 11. And before you get going on a question on verses 12 through 15, I've got a whole lesson I want to preach, and it may turn out to be a series of lessons on 1 Corinthians chapter 7, beginning in verse 1 through verse 39, the whole chapter, okay? So we're going to hold thoughts on those verses, extensive questions at least, on those verses until I get to that lesson, because I want to deal with it in detail far beyond what we have the scope of dealing with it in this class. Okay, Jonathan? All right. 1 Corinthians 7, verses 10 and 11. Paul writes, "But unto the married I give charge, yea, not I, but the Lord, that the wife depart not from her husband." Let's pause right there. What is God's law governing the marriage relationship? All right, one man, one woman, for life. One exception. Let not the man depart from the wife. Let not the wife depart from her husband. Do we see that as a law that comes by divine authority? A man is not to depart from his wife. The wife is not to depart from her husband. Now set that in concrete. That's God's law. Now look at this parenthetical statement. It says, "But should she depart, let her remain unmarried, or else be reconciled unto her husband." Now, I know that there are people who make the argument, "Well, you know, I'm in a bad circumstance. And Paul said that I may depart, but if I do, just remain unmarried. So the solution to my problems is just to divorce or leave and remain unmarried." Now, I want to raise the question to you. How could Paul set forth God's law in the first part of that text and say, "Let her not depart," and then come right around in the parenthetical statement and make accommodations for her to depart? Now explain that to me. Reconcile that for me. You see, I have a real big problem with that. When Paul said, "Do not depart," How can I come along in this parenthetical statement and say now Paul's making accommodations for you to do the very thing he told you not to do? Peggy?
Well, I think under letter G, says it, believer is not to give up Christ to keep the unbeliever. And it may very well be that the unbeliever is making the believer's life so miserable that they can't stay under the same roof. It's either separate or give up Christ, and the believer is not to give up Christ.
That's true, but the believer in that context, and we'll get to that in just a moment, remains passive. We find then that the unbeliever is the one who's active, that's the one who leaves. The believer is to allow them to leave when it is a choice of my unbelieving partner or Christ. You see, I can't give up Christ. Can't do that. But back to verses 10 and 11 of chapter 7, I want you to hold your finger there and turn to 1 John chapter 2. 1 John chapter 2. We see a similar construction in the sentence that I believe is pertinent to the text of 1 Corinthians 7, 10 and 11. In verse 2 of 1 John of chapter 2, verse 2, it says, "And He is the propitiation for our sins." I'm sorry, verse 1. I'm reading the wrong verse. Verse 1. "My little children, these things write I unto you, that ye may not sin." Now let's pause right there. What's God's law? Don't sin. That's the law, isn't it? God doesn't want you to sin. Don't sin. That's the law. Now what if you do? What if you do? Well, he tells us how to deal with it. He says, do not sin. Don't sin. That's why I'm writing it. "And if any man sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous." Do not sin. There's the law. Now, what happens if you do? Here is your option. You have an advocate with the Father, Jesus the Christ. Now, take that comparison back over to 1 Corinthians 7. What's God's law in verse 10? Do not depart. Do not depart. That's the law. Now in this parenthetical statement, rather than to make a provision for you to do the very thing that God told you not to do, this is not a provision, it's not license. What it is comparable to 1 John 2. Don't sin. But if you do, here's your option. Now, if you depart, have you done right? No, you haven't done right. You've committed sin. But if you do that, now what are your options? Be reconciled or remain unmarried. Ken?
So basically, we could also say Paul was telling the woman to be unmarried, but also if it was the man that did it, he was to be unmarried.
That's right. What's fair?
If they both did it,
yeah.
They're both to remain unmarried.
That's right. That's right. Fair for the goose, it's fair for the gander. That's right. It goes both ways. All right? That's right. Now, let's look again at 1 Corinthians 7. He said, "But should she depart, let her remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to her husband." And then the remainder of the verse, "and that the husband leave not his wife." The rule, once again, is one man, one woman, for life. Wives, don't depart. Husbands, don't depart. If you do, have you committed sin? All right, you've committed sin. Now, in 1 John 2, if you sin, don't sin, but if you do, you have an advocate with the Father. Does that mean now that you have an advocate with the Father, your sin is now justified? No, no. If you depart, you have the choice of remaining unmarried or be reconciled. Does that mean that departing is all right? No, no, Judy.
Wouldn't that be like continually sinning?
Yes.
You're not working your marriage out?
Yes. Yes. One man, one woman, for life. That's the plan of God, with one exception. Ken, question?
Yeah, I turns right around and it says that if the believing person has an unbeliever, he's not content to stay, let him go. You're not under bondage. So to me, Paul can't out one side of his mouth say, go and sin.
He didn't say go. He said, let them go.
Right.
He didn't say go.
You still departed. They still departed.
No, he said, let them go. Let them depart. He's not telling you to depart, you see. He said, let them go. If it's the choice between Christ or them, let them go. You see, the believer remains passive. Yes, Wendy?
So what if it's the reverse and you have to go? Then why are you going after anyone? You're going after trying to do the right thing.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm trying to do the right thing when I'm the one departing, you see. He says, don't depart. Well, we've got the believer and the unbeliever hitched in these next verses. Well, if the unbeliever is unwilling to leave, then it appears the unbeliever is willing to sustain the marriage. The circumstance that we were talking about from verses 12 through 15, let's read it. Verses 12 through 15. It says, but to the rest say I, not the Lord. If any brother hath an unbelieving wife, and she is content to dwell with him, let him not leave her. And the woman that hath an unbelieving husband, and he is content to dwell with her, let her not leave her husband. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified in the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified in the brother. Else were your children unclean, but now are they holy. Yet if the unbelieving departeth, let him depart. The brother or the sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us in peace. Here is not a case where two believers are married and one is making life difficult. In this case, we have a believer married to an unbeliever. And the unbeliever is not content to be married to the believer. The unbeliever insists, you make a choice. It's Christ or me. Then Paul says, let them depart. The brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases. Now, it's interesting to note the term bondage. Again, I'm going to talk about this in the sermon that I have prepared to present and deal with this in some detail. But the bondage that he's talking about here is not the bond of marriage. He's simply indicating by the use of the word in this text, the servant of. The believer is not the servant of the unbeliever. In other words, the unbeliever does not have dominion over the choices that I make. My choices still are made in relationship to Christ. I'm not the servant. I'm not the slave of the unbeliever. I don't have to do what the unbeliever tells me to do when he says, forsake the Lord. I can't do it. I'm not under bondage to him. And the word or the text here is, I never have been under bondage to him. I never have in the marriage relationship been a slave either to my husband or my wife. I'm a slave to Christ. And that's the bottom line of that. Okay, David?
The unbeliever leaves. And the believer lets him leave. Can the believer now be married?
No, sir. The Apostle Paul, in the context of 1 Corinthians 7, verses 12 through verse 15, does not even introduce the subject of remarriage. It's foreign to the text. He's not even talking about remarriage. And the very fact that he doesn't use the word that talks about the marriage bond excludes the marriage bond from the discussion of this text. He's not talking about that. He's using a word that talks about slavery. And he indicates that the believer is not the slave of the unbeliever. He never has been, or she never has been. Okay, so he's not discussing remarriage at all, not even introduced in this text. All right, now I want to go on and talk about some other things. When we study this divorced person, we understand that it doesn't matter who they are, if they are divorced for the cause of fornication or if they are divorced because they burned the beans. That doesn't give them liberty to be free from divine law to do what they please. Okay? It doesn't give them liberty to form another relationship. Again, consider the word adultery as it's used by the Lord in Matthew 19:9. Jesus used the word adultery, and it means unlawful sexual intercourse involving someone under the constraint of divine law. Now, who would that be? That would be the person who's put away for fornication. They don't escape divine law. That would be the person who's put away for reasons other than fornication. They too do not escape divine law. So when a remarriage is formed, what did Jesus call it? He called it adultery. Do we see that? That's what he called it. He called it adultery. All right, Peggy, a question or comment?
I think I'll say it.
All right, that's fine. All right. So the word adultery would apply to a married man who is with another man's wife. You see that? That doesn't need explaining. A married man with another man's wife is committing adultery. You see also that a man who puts away his wife without cause, that is, he puts her away for some reason other than fornication, and he marries, what did Jesus say he did? Adultery. All right, a woman who is put away without cause. Let's say I divorce Donna because she burns the beans, and she becomes another man's wife. What did Jesus call that? Adultery. All right, the put away fornicator. Let's suppose that I commit fornication, and Donna divorces me because I'm over here messing around with some other woman. I'm the put away fornicator. If I marry another, what did Jesus call that? Adultery. Now that's not hard to see even by the definition of the word, is it? That's adultery. That's right.
Whether Christian, believer, or unbeliever.
That's right.
I think that that's oftentimes what gets confusing, because there is false doctrine out there.
That's right.
That non-Christians are not amenable to the law of Christ concerning marriage, and that's wrong.
That's true. I've got a chart on that, and we're going to talk about that from the standpoint of Matthew 19:9. All right?
There's one more class.
Okay.
In Matthew 19:9, it says that whoever divorces his wife except for immorality and marries another woman commits adultery with the other woman.
Well, that's right. Yeah.
He's also guilty.
That's right. Don't tell me I'm out of time. I'm plumb out of time, or I got 5 minutes. All right.
She's never been married.
All right, that's right. That's right. That other woman who may never have been married, but she marries a man that has already been married and either put away for fornication or put away not for fornication, she too becomes guilty of adultery. All right. Rebecca?
I can't be totally certain that that's exactly what they're referring to, but it falls under the umbrella of what Randy said in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 39, when it says, a wife is bound to her husband as long as she lives, but if her husband dies,
Romans.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're going to talk about that. I've got some charts I'm going to prepare on that. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 39.
It's obvious that she's free to marry whomever she wishes as long as it's under God's law.
Under divine law. That's right. Under divine law. Now, just to answer your question, I don't know who said that, but I'm not persuaded that the context of 1 Corinthians 7, verse 39 demands that she must marry a Christian. But she must marry under the restraint of divine law. Now, we'll have to talk about what that entails. But she must marry under restraint of divine law. Now, how can we know when it is right to marry another mate? Well, we know we can remarry if our mate dies. Romans 7 teaches that. We know that we can remarry if we put away a mate for the cause of fornication. Now you take divine law and show me outside the circle of that where a man can remarry or a woman can remarry with God's approval. Now in those two circumstances, I know that that's right. Now outside of that, you're risking your soul. I'll not do it. Right. Right. She don't need to be with him.
Because she's unlawfully married to him anyway.
Yeah.
So once that divorce is final, can she remarry?
That's a good question. I like to answer questions like that periodically. That's a good question. And you know what that introduces? Whether she's free from... No, I don't have a chart. No. Whether or not she's free from divine law. Is she free from divine law? Has she ever been joined to that man? Did God join her to that man? Now that raises all kinds of questions that we can speculate about. David? All right? And answers to questions like that would be speculation. Whether or not God had bound her to that man. Now in these two instances, I know the answer to them. I don't have any qualms about that. I know the answer to them. You want to go out on a limb and risk your soul? That's your business. You see the point. Now I know when I can marry another. The Bible tells me so. The Bible answers that question. Now we can create scenarios that become difficult. But when I ask the question, how can I know that I can marry somebody else? I plug it into Romans 7 or Matthew 19, and I've got the answer to that. Oh, certainly.
Because that binding, we kind of blow that off like it's nothing. But when we see things that were bound, God destroyed people for it. So we need to be careful in binding things too.
Well, that's exactly right. But when somebody asks me a question relative to these things, whether or not I can know this answer, I know this is right. I know this is right. I don't have to question it. Because I can put a book, chapter, and verse right beside of the scenario and know it's right. Joey, all right. I want to look in what time we have remaining, which doesn't appear to be very much. Peggy, you brought up this subject, and I said I had a chart on it. To whom does God's law apply? You're familiar with this text, so I'm going to focus on the word whosoever shall put away his wife. Go sit down, John. Whosoever shall put away his wife. Does that tell us the context of what Jesus said? He's not just talking to Jews, as some people want to argue. He's not just talking to those Pharisees who's raised the question. Jesus is referred or has referred to God's law from the beginning. And now his commentary on that is, whosoever shall put away his wife. Who does that apply to?
Everybody.
The law of God from the beginning, Genesis 2:24, is universal in its application. Now, there's a reason why we know that's so. And we're going to talk about that, evidently, next week. Okay? And you might study that under the scope of the demands of repentance. Under the demands of repentance. Just to give you a heads up, you'll notice that the Apostle Paul, to those in Athens in Acts chapter 17, commanded that all men everywhere must repent. What's that suggest to you about God's law?